Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
All right. Welcome to another edition of the Sustainable Ag Writer. I hope you are all doing well out there. It's Sunday morning when I'm taping this opening, and it's actually sunny out. The last few openings I taped, we had very rainy, dreary weather, so I'm glad to see the sunshine out today. And I hope you're all coping with our ongoing crises in the United States. We're tough and resilient people in this country, and I think slowly but surely we're going to get through this. So continue to look after one another, continue to do the things that we need to do to make ourselves whole again. Today's show is all about soils. And I wanted to do this show is to start getting more into agricultural related topics. And I thought no better place to start than with the soil, because the soil is the foundation of everything we do in agriculture. If your soils aren't right, nothing else is going to be right. So this week I came across a couple of articles online that I want to share with you. And they both covered the same issue. One article was put out by Yale Environment 360, which I think is some sort of online digest put out by the Environmental Department of Yale University. And the other was a report from NPR, which basically covers the same thing. The title of the Yale article is One Third of Farmland in the U.S. Corn Belt Has Lost Its Topsoil. The article starts out by saying more than a third of the farmland in the U.S. Corn Belt, nearly 100 million acres, has completely lost its carbon-rich topsoil due to erosion. Think about that for a minute. That's an incredible number, 100 million acres. This is according to a new study published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The article further goes on to say, the study led by scientists at the University of Massachusetts Amherst found that the greatest loss of carbon-rich topsoil was on hilltops and ridgelines, indicating that tillage or repeated plowing of fields was large as loosened soils moved downslope. Previous research, the report goes on, has shown that no-till farming practices can have a significant impact on reducing erosion. And if farmers shifted entirely to no-till practices, it would reduce soil erosion from U.S. agricultural fields by more than 70%, helping to significantly reduce nutrient and sediment runoff and improve water quality around thousands of miles of rivers and streams. So 100 million acres, that's an incredible number. One third of the topsoil in the heart of the Midwest has been lost. Now I have to point out that in both this and in the NPR article, there is some disputing of that number. Some folks think that it's overestimated. But as one scientist said in the NPR article, it doesn't matter if it's 40% or 20%. The fact is, we're losing topsoil. So I wanted to do this show today on soils. I'm going to talk with Justin Duncan, a sustainable ag technician with the National Center for Appropriate Technology. And he's going to talk about what small farms can do about soils and what we should look for in our soils. What are the important makeups in soils and how can we build them up and make them as healthy as we can so we can grow healthy crops? You know, a lot of farmers, even myself, sometimes didn't really pay as much attention to our soils as we should. Most farmers just say, I'm going to add some lime and a few fertilizers and amendments here and there, and I'll be all right. But there's more to soils than that. Soil's the foundation of farming. You wouldn't build a house on a rickety or substandard foundation. You know, sooner or later, the building is going to come tumbling down if you do that. And I think we're starting to see that we've built our agricultural structures on top of an unsound foundation. We've constantly tilled our soils. We've engaged in monocultures without practicing crop rotations. All of these practices can pay back immense benefits and create healthy soils and help to do things like deter pests and grow more nutrient-dense foods. So we really need to get back into the habit of not tilling off our soils and not growing the same crop in the same place year after year after year. The NPR article goes on to say that there's no quick solution. Anna Kate, a Minnesota State soil health specialist, says there's no quick solution, but there are ways to farm that can also rebuild topsoil. They involve less tilling or none at all. Farmers can grow grass and harvest hay rather than corn. And so that brings me to something that we're going to talk about. We're going to continually explore in this program. What priorities should we have in terms of agricultural production? Most people in agriculture, especially if they're associated with the USDA, have some strong opinions about crop production. Agriculture's soybeans, agriculture's peanuts, agriculture's corn, agriculture's cotton. And on top of all of these top-line commodity crops require heavy inputs, including fertilizers and pesticides. Now, don't be mistaken. What American agriculture has achieved in being able to create high yields and to get productivity out of land that many people think was impossible not too long ago has been impressive. I think in the 50s, it was called the Green Revolution. Well, what we're seeing now is that that productivity has come at a price. You know, everything has its cost and the environment is claiming its pound of flesh. So yes, we can produce bumper crops of corn and bumper crops of soybean, but the trade-off is we often sacrifice the health of our soils and the quality of our water. And it's time for us to start looking at that, especially in this age where climate change is a real threat that needs to be dealt with. I had an interesting exchange with someone on Facebook the other day. This person said he took a ride around South Dakota recently and he saw thousands of acres of farmland. He said it had grass on it. I can't recall the name of the grass at this time, but the land was just covered with this grass and it would be perfect for carbon sequestration. And a person made the point that money that will be generated for carbon sequestration programs would be going to white farmers. And that's what Biden is doing for the American farm. I'm happy to think that he's going to be doing a lot more. But the theory behind this person's opinion is that none of that money is going to help black farmers. So I had to respond to him. I spent a little time in North Dakota before this pandemic hit. And one of the things that struck me was just the size of the farms up there. Farms of 5,000 acres, 10,000 acres. And I'm used to dealing with farms down here in the South, especially with farmers of color. A large farm is a few hundred acres. I recently met, not too long ago, a black farmer whose family owns a 1,000-acre farm in Middle Georgia. But those types of farms that are owned by a black folk are an exception rather than the rule. Carbon sequestration requires, more than anything, large amounts of land mass. And what I said to this poster is that, well, that approach makes a lot of sense because, you know, black farmers just don't have that land mass. So white farmers would be a primary target of any carbon sequestration program. Now, we can be angry about the reason why black farmers don't have farms that are 5,000 or 10,000 acres. There are some very legitimate and very real reasons why that's not a reality in today's America. I think the estimate is 20 or 30 million acres of land was lost, and a lot of people say stolen from black farmers over the last 50 to 60 years, but that's a whole separate issue. If you want to reduce climate change, carbon sequestration will be a major factor, and you will need large land masses to achieve this, and as much as many of us don't like it, there will be significant funding directed to white farmers, because to paraphrase the bank robber Willie Sutton, that's where the land is. So a lot of black farmers may be listening to this and be saying, well, why is that something I should be involved in? Well, first of all, you should care about your soil health on your farm because it's your farm. And if you're growing crops or if you're raising livestock, you want to grow the healthiest and safest crops and livestock that you can. And that starts with your soil. We all have a role to play in climate change. And we all should be doing what we can to reduce it. I'm not a soil scientist, so I often had to turn to the experts to learn about this stuff. But one of the things that I've been starting to read a lot of articles about is a new term out there called regenerative agriculture. And I use the term new relatively loosely. According to Regeneration International, regenerative agriculture describes farming and grazing practices that, among other benefits, reverse climate change by rebuilding soil organic matter and restoring degraded soil biodiversity, resulting in both carbon drawdown and improving the water cycle. Specifically, regenerative agriculture is a holistic land management practice that leverages the power of photosynthesis in plants to close the carbon cycle and to build soil health, crop resilience, and nutrient density. Regenerative agriculture improves soil health primarily through the practices that increase soil organic matter. I'm probably going to do a separate show on the issue of people of color having issues with the sudden interest in regenerative agriculture and how the term is being used. Essentially, what a lot of folks are saying is that, look, that's the way indigenous people have been farming for millennia. And now to have it repurposed primarily through our white lands does a disservice to all the work that has been done by indigenous peoples. And I happen to agree with that. So we need to move back to what's old is new now. We need to start moving back to what my friend Felicia Bell calls traditional forms of agriculture. And it's going to be hard and difficult to get a lot of these farmers in the Midwest who've been growing corn and soybeans their whole life. And to be honest, moving towards these practices can even be a tough sell among black farmers. These farmers are used to farming a certain way, and it can be difficult to introduce practices like no-till. And I'll give you an example. I was at a conference back when we could still attend conferences in person, and I happened to be talking with a couple of folks about no-till and sustainable ag methods that can help larger farmers. There was a young man from Texas, and he said, you know, everybody around me believes in the concept of clean dirt, and that if he was going to implement a no-till system, his neighbors would call him and complain. Apparently, his family still owned the property, and he said his neighbors would call his parents and tell them how horrible his farm looked if he tried to implement no-till procedures. I really didn't get what he was trying to say until I drove home. And like, I think I was in Texas, driving through Texas or some parts of Mississippi, and I really didn't get what he was trying to say at that time. But as I drove home, I was amazed at farm after farm, as far as the eye could see, was nothing but pristine dirt. You couldn't see a blade of grass or a twig. You couldn't even tell what was grown there in that field during the past season. And then it hit me. That's what clean dirt is. Absolutely void, devoid of any organic matter in the soil. And so I think it's going to be a tough road. So this farmer was under, even though his heart was in the right place, he was under cultural pressures to farm the way his parents farm and the way his great-grandparents, and his great-grandparents farm. And that, in this particular case, it meant having fields that could be considered clean dirt. And so these cultural norms were preventing these farmers, the social pressures were preventing these farmers from trying to implement soil-friendly practices onto his farm. And so I think it's going to be a tough road, but I think a lot of these larger farmers are now starting to get why they need to be interested in soil health. Like, even me, one of the things I've been trying to figure out since I started farming on my land 15 years ago was how I can introduce crop rotations and cover crops on a piece of small acreage. If you've got 50 acres and you want to practice crop rotation, it's a little bit easier proposition than if you have 2 to 5 acres. Sometimes you may need to forego income and just plant cover crops. You may need to implement fast-growing cover crops before your season so you can get the benefits of those crops. You just have to figure out a way of rotating those crops in some form or fashion. But we also need to look at implementing this practice if for no other reason it will make our farms healthier. And I think these larger farmers are starting to look at their practices and seeing how it's contributing to the degradation of soils. So today we're going to be speaking with Justin Duncan, a sustainable agriculture technician with the National Center for Appropriate Technology. And Justin is going to be talking with us about soils, minerals, salt, and pigeon bees. Stay tuned. I hope you enjoy the interview. Welcome to another edition of The Sustainable Writer. I'm here with Justin Duncan, who is the Sustainable Ag Technician at the National Center for Appropriate Technology. How you doing today, Justin?
I'm all right. How you doing?
Not too bad. We were just talking about your trials and tribulations down there in Texas. What part of Texas are you in?
I'm down in Prairie View.
Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't think Prairie View got hit that bad, but I guess you got
hit. Oh, yeah. Huh? It got down to, the power company says it got down to 4 degrees.
Oh, wow. Wow. You ever had temperatures like that before?
Never in life.
Oh, man.
Back in 83, it froze and the pipes burst and all that sort of thing. But that was, you know, just a day or so. This one was like a sustained week of just cold.
Yeah. Wow. Did you lose water too? You have to go out and scrounge for water?
Yeah, because the pipes bust. You know, I try to take some precautions, but it just wasn't made for temperatures that cold.
So yeah.
Now it's all fixed and insulated and all that sort of stuff. So hopefully this won't happen again.
Yeah. You were able to get a plumber. You did everything yourself.
Oh, I did it myself, man.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So yeah. Us farmers have got to be handy, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, thank you for being on the show today. I wanted to bring you on because, you know, in the groups that we participate in a lot together, you always bring a lot of knowledge as it comes to soil and healthy soil. And that's what I want to talk about today. You know, so many farmers really don't pay attention to their soil. So my first question for you is, why is soil so important in agriculture?
Soil is important because it's the basis of crop health. It's not just a place for plants to grow. It's not just an anchor point. It's where they derive their nutrition. You know, when I say nutrition, I don't mean just NPK. NPK is not nutrition to me. NPK is a facet of nutrition. When I say nutrition, I mean full mineral spectrum nutrition. Every element that is known and unknown that's necessary, to be necessary for plant growth. We need all that stuff. You know, it's everything. You know. Yeah. And I used to be that guy, you know, my background is in plants. I love my plants. I didn't care about the soils, but I went to school for agronomy. And agronomy is, of course, field crops and soil science. Mm-hmm. A lot of soil science classes. And I didn't see the point at the time. But now that I'm older and more feathered and more experienced and not just a little plant geek running around chasing. I understand how, you know, really important the soil is. And it's not just a mineral. It's the life that lives in the soil, all the biology, the mycorrhiza, rhizobium, all the things that live in the soil that make it a good place for plants to live.
Yeah. So I saw you respond to a couple of people in the group when they were asking about particular diseases that their plants have. Oh, and especially they were getting pests. And you've been pretty consistent in saying that pests generally just attack unhealthy plants. So if you have unhealthy plants, is that an indication that something's the matter with your soil?
Right. So, I mean, if you think about plants, they can't really move away. Like if you're at home and your house catches on fire, you can walk away. You can leave. If it's flooding, you can go somewhere else. But plants don't have that option. They're in place. And so since they're in place, everything they need has to be right there within reach for them. You know, we as human beings tend to try to force nature to do what we want. In literature, they call it man versus nature. Man needs to understand that we are a part of nature. We can't just force plants to do what we want. We have to look for the needs of the plant. And, you know, there's a lot of leeway in the environments we can manipulate and light requirements and shade and water and all that sort of things. But when it comes down to it, you're not giving a plant exactly what it needs to be happy, it's going to be stressed. Once it's stressed, it starts telling the environment that it's stressed, or through the use of semiochemicals or allele chemicals or you know, basically chemical transmitters. The environment knows that the plant is stressed. And so a couple of things happen. First, when plants start emitting these chemicals, to let the environment know that they're stressed. Let's say that your crops are being attacked by Liguus bugs or something like that. Whatever chemical defenses the plant can make to hinder the production of the Liguus, the other plants around it will start emitting that same chemical in response. Been affected yet? They'll start making that same chemical response. Now, the other thing is that the pests of those plants, they hunt chemicals. They're like, oh, there's food there. There's something over there that's suffering. Let me go over there and destroy it and put it out of its misery. And that's what happens when plants get hit by pests. The plants let the environment know I'm suffering, and nature, in its mercy or cruelty, depending on how you want to look at it, and takes that plant out.
Gotcha.
When we grow things without all the minerals necessary in the soil, you create a weak plant, and that weak plant is easier to be destroyed. A good example of this is a fungus called Alternaria. Alternaria is everywhere. It's a it's what we call a facultative saprophyte. It's a type of fungus that it lives on dead and decaying tissue. If there is a weakened plant, it can affect that weakened plant and start messing with it. So in Texas, we have pomegranate trees. We see that are not ripening very much anymore. The fruits turn brown. They get rotted before they even can get a chance to mature. And that's because of Alternaria. Alternaria floats around and it finds these pomegranates, these ripening fruit. And they're like, oh, this plant's stressed. Let me get in here because it's already weakened. And this is a good place for me to live. The plant is not getting exactly what it needs to make all of its secondary metabolites and defensive mechanisms and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, I'm pretty consistent with the minerals necessary, because that's a major step. You know, once you step away from the minerals, then you get into light requirements and all the other stuff.
Yeah. So let's talk about the minerals for a minute, because you really hear people when they're talking about their, even organic farmers to a certain extent, when they start to talk about the quality of their soils, they'll generally look at how much nitrogen's there, how much phosphates are in the soil, that type of stuff. But people, you know, even myself included, I'm guilty of this, really don't take a hard look at the minerals that are in the soil and or the lack of thereof, and how that can be affecting, you know, your crops. So can you talk a little bit about what those minerals are and what farmers should be doing to make sure that they have the proper minerals in their soils?
So that's a good question. So the minerals, it's not specific. You have to imagine that plants are like mines. They're like a gold mine or like a copper mine. And every time that you harvest from that plant or you harvest from that field, everything that it took to grow that plant, to produce that fruit or to grow that root crop, everything that put into it from the soil is now taken away from the field. So if you've got a gold mine and you run out of gold, you move on to another place. You move to another mountain, another stream bed, you know, somewhere else to get gold. Plants can't do that, and farmers don't do that. We used to have like fallowed fields and all that sort of thing, but now our agriculture tends to lean towards, you know, we're growing the same thing year after year, or we're doing a specific cycle year after year. So the minerals are, it's best to say it this way. Go to your periodic table, look at it, and those are the minerals needed in the soil. And when I say known and unknown, that's coming from, you know, from the literature. There's some guys that I learned this from, and this knowledge is old. It's, you know, they started writing about this back in the day. A guy named Julius Hensel in Germany, he started talking about rock dust and how he was fixing all sorts of crop and pest issues, health issues, by taking rock dust and mixing it into the soil of the fields. And, you know, if you read his book, Bread from Stones, it's really dramatic, the results he was getting from that. Then later you get a guy named Dr. Maynard Murray. And this guy was, he was a genius, but, you know, he was kind of crazy too. He had these Navy guys bringing him truckloads of seawater on his fields. And he was looking at the results he was getting, because he surmised that if rain falls on this land, this water goes somewhere and it ultimately ends up in the ocean. But he was thinking about what is this process by which the minerals that are leached from the soil, how do they get back? And so he kind of made a stopgap measure by going to the sea and bringing that water and putting on his fields. And he had some pretty dramatic results. There was another guy, Dr. William Albrecht. He founded some soil testing. Well, he had a train of thought, or he had a dynamic, or he had a way of doing things. His students went on to found other soil labs, and he really, really, you know, wanted people to use, you know, full spectrum mineral nutrition for their crops. This has evolved to come full circle to, you know, now people are like, there's got to be a better way to do this. What am I doing wrong? And so, you know, in short, the minerals are periodic table. Julius Hensel, he used rock dust. And, you know, Maynard Murray, he used sea salt. I use azomite or sea salt, and it depends on where I am in the season. If it's before the season, I incorporate micronized azomite, and azomite is it's basically weathered, fossilized volcanic ash that's turned into clay. You know, back in the days, Yellowstone National Park, it was a super volcano. Mm-hmm. When it blows up, it dumps all this ash all over the place out in Utah and all that. Mm-hmm. We collect all that weathered mineral, that azomite, and pulverize it and screen it, and they sell it for farmers to use in their fields. Before the season, I use that. I mix that in with the soil, and it works for me.
Where do you source your azomite from?
I get it from a guy named Thomas Haar. He's down in Victoria, Texas.
Okay.
And I think his place is Earthwise Organics.
Earthwise Organics, okay.
And let me confirm that, because
I know a lot of people go to Seven Springs up there in Virginia.
Yeah, Seven Springs is another place. I just found out about that one. But it's Earthwise.
Earthwise Organics. Okay, I'll put that in the show notes.
But Seven Springs, I've recommended that to people. Mm-hmm. They were closer. They were over there on the East Coast.
Okay.
But he's just closer to me, and I've worked with him when I was on the executive board of the Texas Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. So okay. I know him, so I go. But so during the season, if there's a deficiency, I use sea salt. And you know, I used to do, well, I still do if somebody needs one, but I do soil remineralization classes. And, you know, I'll go out and I'll talk to a group and, you know, tell them about all the stuff that's supposed to be in the soil, why it's not there. Because, you know, within, like I mentioned, plants are mines. And within 10 years of agricultural production, you pretty much strip the soil of its micronutrients and trace elements. And those are those things that the plants use in a secondary defensive metabolites and that sort of thing. So, you know, I was giving these classes talking about soil remineralization and how they needed to, you know, look at this and they needed to pay attention to this. And one time I gave the class at the Last Organic Outpost in Houston. It was an urban farm. It was situated on a parking lot of an old rice mill. So it was like a 2-acre lot. All of their beds were compost. You know, the guy was telling me, Joe Isett, he was telling me, you know, Justin, everything's yellow out here. Things aren't producing very well. What can you do? What can you help me with? And so I went out there and I looked at the situation. And I was like, only growing in compost. And he's like, yeah. And I was like, there is no way for these plants to get the micronutrients and trace elements they need. So I left him with a sample of some sea salt. And they have companies that sell sea salt for agricultural uses. I'm not picky. You know, there's sea minerals, FA and C90 and all those other
plants. Oh, okay. I've seen those. Yeah.
Look, mm-hmm. man, I'm not picky. I got some pink Himalayan salt.
Mm-hmm.
I mix it up, spray it on the crops if need be, and they'll be okay. And so that's what he did. After the class, he went out there and mixed it up like I told him, because it's salt. So you have to be cognizant that it's salt.
And, right.
you're using it on plants, you have to use it a certain way. So he mixed up like I told him, and they sprayed the farm down. He called me up at my office at Prairie View, and he was so excited. He was so excited. He was like, Justin, everything's green. It's so beautiful out here. It's so lush. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm like, well, yeah. So just remember that you need some minerals in your crops. And so now on the other hand, I had some other guys, they didn't listen to instructions, and they were dealing with crops that were in a hydroponic situation. They use way too much salt and they burn up their stuff. And then they call me complaining. And then I had them walk me through the process, and I found out that they were not using level tablespoons of sea salt. They were using heaping tablespoons.
Ah, okay.
So you can't go into the salt box and find your grandma and your mom and your relatives and your in that salt and dump it on your plants and think you're going to have good results. You have to measure it out. You know, I've stopped telling people it's 2 tablespoons per gallon because folks don't know how to follow directions. But the official is 2 level tablespoons of sea salt per gallon of water, and you use it as a foliar feed. You know, mix it up, put it in a spray bottle, spray your plants in the evening. Overnight, those minerals will absorb through the leaves, and they'll be happy, happy. Okay. You don't have to do it very often, but you need to do it as needed.
Okay. And now is that like a full spectrum minerals, or it gives you enough of what you need?
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right. Because like I was saying, like when the rain falls on the land, it picks up minerals as leachate. It takes all the leachate out to the river. Everything's soluble going out to the river somewhere. And so when it gets to the river, that river's taking it straight to the ocean. Once it gets to the ocean, it's just kind of there until we have an event. Like, you remember the tsunami?
Yes. Yep, I sure do.
So after that tsunami, everyone was so worried that they were never going to be able to grow crops in their fields. They were never going to be able to use those fields again because they were salted. But you know what happened? Those folks started having bumper crops.
Wow.
Because their soil was remineralized. It was revitalized. It was resuscitated. Because the ocean came through those fields and left all those minerals behind. Now, of course, sodium by itself is not what you're looking for. That needs to be leached out of the soil, because sodium by itself, or salt by itself, sodium chloride, is a dispersant. It destroys soil structure, soil compaction, and all that. So that's why you see so many problems with saline soils and sodic soils and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad you said that, because I know, you know, I grow in hoop houses. I don't know if you have some, but I know you're familiar with them. One of the concerns that folks have about high tunnels, especially if you've been growing in them year after year after year, is the potential for salt buildups in the soil, because you are not you're not getting that rainfall to carry a lot of that stuff off. So, A, is that really a problem? And B, what should, you know, folks like me who's had a high tunnel in one spot for going on 8 years now, and really no rainwater has hit those inside beds at all.
So on A, is it a problem? It depends on soil, on your water quality. Like out here in Prairie View, our water is full of iron and manganese. So if you're irrigating off city water, and that's chloramine, other garbage they put in there. If you're watering from city water, then yeah, it's going to build up, because they're okay. So when people say salts, it's not just table salt or sodium. It's all the mineral salts, and those things they build up in the soil, and they can cause crusting and discoloration and all that. Right. Sort of. They can build up to toxic levels, because both iron and manganese are going to make your soil very acidic. You say, is that a problem for people in high tunnels? What are you seeing now in your crops? Have you noticed any depressed fertility?
No.
You haven't seen any problems?
No.
Right. So if you're in that situation and you're worried about soil quality, about the best thing you can do is use compost, good leaf mold type compost.
Gotcha.
Good natural compost. Use that. because compost or, you know, other organic matter, it helps break up chemical toxicities when things are too much. Even aluminum, which is highly toxic to plants. When you mix organic matter into the soil, it's very helpful in breaking up that toxicity, because organic matter is composed of these huge molecules, these very, very long chain molecules. Once they start encountering these toxic metals like aluminum, manganese, and all that, it locks them in. It grabs those ions or whichever, grabs them in, holds them, and it makes them basically less toxic for the plants. It's grow things like sunflowers.
Okay.
Sunflowers are greedy. They and they suck up everything. They're bioremediation plants. Hemp is one of those as well. I don't know if you can grow hemp out there, but
yeah,
another one that can be used for bioremediation.
Yeah, so, I heard that about hemp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want a plant that is greedy like that. They have, you know, plants can absorb through exchange, or they absorb water by a mass flow. Sunflowers are one, they absorb by mass flow. And that means just suck up everything like a huge straw. They use it to build more sunflowers. Those are good bioremediation crops.
Okay. So let's say I'm Joe New Farmer, and I've got a piece of land, and I'm going to do, let's just say, some market gardening type stuff, some leafy greens, some tomatoes, peppers, stuff you typically see at a farmer's market. First time I'm going to work on this land, what should be the first thing I do? Now, if you go to someplace like NRCS, they'll say get that standard soil test, which really just checked, you know, the amount of lime that you have and your phosphate levels and stuff like that. But if you really want to understand your soils, what should you be doing?
The first thing that I do is I walk the land and look and see what's growing there, because I'm going to let nature tell me what that land is suitable for. So I was out in Georgia some weeks ago.
Hey, you got Bobby's place, Bobby Wilson's place.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. I went out to Bobby Wilson's. Bobby and I had a good conversation about what was growing, and folks think I'm a little weird, but you know, I'm a for true plant guy. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm really, really into my plants, and mm-hmm. it's more than in a profession; it's an obsession. So I walk the tree, the fence line or the tree line, and I see all these fantastic things growing there. He had some wild cherries and some wild roses. He had some blackberries. I'm like, Mr. Wilson, your land is telling you grow strawberries, mm-hmm. grow blackberries, you know, grow these members of the rose family. They like right. there. Don't fight nature. Fight nature, because she's bigger than you and she's a bully. Yeah. So we walked the tree line and we talked about that. That's the first thing I do when I go to a new property. I walk mm-hmm. around and I look at what weeds are growing out there. I look at what trees are growing out there, and I come up with a list of plants that make it easier on Mr. Joe New Farmer, because farming is already hard enough. You know, your soil is trying to communicate with you, or your plants are trying to communicate with you. It's up to us to understand what they're trying to say. You know, our soil and our plants, they're trying to talk to us. They're trying to communicate with us. And it's up to us to try to reach out and understand what they're trying to tell us. If we don't, then we come up and we start butting heads against nature. We come up against nature and have that fight on our hands. So look and see what's growing out there and think about, what is it related to? You've got a bunch of silverleaf nightshade. Well, if I see silverleaf nightshade, that means that I can grow peppers or eggplants very easily in this land. If you've got physalis or the Chinese lantern, the little husk tomato type things.
Yeah.
If you've got those, you know, those are just tomatillos, and you mm-hmm. can tomatoes out there with relative ease. So, you know, the land is trying to talk to us. And so, mm-hmm. You know, it's not hard. Just listen. And so, That's the first thing I do. I walk the land, I look and see what the potentials are. Yeah, there's a lot of things that you can do to alter the environment and, you know, build structures and do this and that and the other. But if you do that, you run against resiliency. And resiliency is what we want. You know, like out of my place, I try to keep things that are they're within this environment. They're germane to the environment. Things that will flourish here because I'm lazy. I don't want to go out there and do a bunch of extra stuff.
You were telling me about walking the land at Bobby Wilson's place. And for those of you who don't know, Bobby Wilson owns Metro Atlanta Urban Farms, which is probably the oldest, if not one of the oldest, urban ag operations in Atlanta, if not the country. But anyway, what I was saying is that someone would probably look at all those plants that you were mentioning, like the wild cherries and the wild roses, and then go plow them under or dig them up and put something that's diametrically opposed to telling them to put there, you know?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's the case so often, you know, mm-hmm. people get new land and the first thing they want to do is clear it all off. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, did you find out what was growing there before? They're like, it was just weeds. But what kind? You know, what mm-hmm. were they? I would look at what's growing out there and figure out, remember when I was talking about the physalis and the mm-hmm. silver jade and all that?
Yeah.
Okay. Good deal. All right. So yeah, and then once I have an understanding of what can grow, then I'd move forward to, you know, what varieties do well for me. Mm-hmm. Plant a bunch of different things, and see what they do, and see how they do, and then go from there. You know, start looking at what can grow there easy. Don't try to fight, because. Right. That's a big battle. Yeah. See what can grow there easy and then concentrate on those things. Mm-hmm. One thing that I did while I was at Prairie View, I was a greenhouse manager there for about 7 years and took care of the mm-hmm. research plots and the greenhouses, built a fruit orchard the apiary or the bees, beekeeping. Mm-hmm. So I grew different things in the fields and I saw that sweet potatoes did great. With little or no care, they would, you know, you plant a little cutting or a slip and it would just start getting everywhere. And in the wintertime, strawberries did really well for us. We have insect problems and all that sort of thing. We just, you know, a bunch of strawberries, they did well. So wow. I concentrated on those two things because there's something that a local producer could easily get into. And they did well. Now, the thing that I was looking at for the sweet potatoes is this weevil, because down here, yes. mm-hmm. we have a sweet potato weevil, Silas formicarius. It really, really hinders sweet potato production in mm-hmm. town. And I was trying to look at ways to get rid of the weevil or keep the weevil from messing with them. So then yeah.
there was a woman down in McAllen, all the way down at the tip of Texas down there. And I guess that area of Texas gets really, really hot in the summer. So they can't grow a lot of their regular crops. So she was doing a research project on whether they can grow organic sweet potatoes.
Oh, and that was Lois Kim.
Yes, it was.
Yes,
yeah. That was one of her problems, the weevils.
Well, yeah. The weevils were an issue, but, you know, they were right there on the river. So the hog.
That's what she told me. Yeah.
Yeah, the hogs were an issue. Mm-hmm. And then that soil is more alkaline than sweet potatoes really wanted.
Okay.
She was on the right track. Brennan, when I tell you those sweet potato vines were so lush and beautiful, mm-hmm. it looked like a cover crop.
Wow.
And that's where I wanted to go from there. I looked at the field and, you know, that's the work we're doing with that farm was looking at different mm-hmm. And she did that side project in sweet potatoes, and I was like, "My gosh, this stuff covers it kills out the sunflower. Sunflowers are a major weed down in that area."
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the potential for sweet potatoes for the vinage to mm-hmm. be a cover crop is huge.
Wow. Okay.
And that's where I wanted to go with that, but you know, we've gone in some other directions, and then. You know, the PPC had some issues, and so they're no longer in business. That was because of
what that farm?
Yeah, the lightning strike took out their building, took out their headquarters.
Oh, really? Okay.
And like there was all sorts of drama because of it.
That was a pretty big operation too.
Yeah, through no fault of their own.
It was, yeah. Hey, that's farming, man. You never know what's going to come hit you. You know.
Right. And that brings me back to the point of resiliency. Mm-hmm. If you grow what nature wants you to grow, you build in that natural resiliency. You don't have so many problems with crop losses because, you know, you've got something that would grow there anyway on its own. And, you know, so, it's just something to think about.
So, Justin, in addition to the minerals, two big things you always hear that contribute to soil health are making sure you do crop rotation and making sure you do cover crops. So, in your opinion, are these really, is this something that farmers should be adopting into their practices to maintain soil health, or it's they could get by without doing it?
No, you should rotate. And different plants take up different minerals from the soil in different amounts. So like people do crop rotation because it breaks up pest cycles, it breaks up disease cycles. Also gives the soil just a little bit of time to rest because different minerals are being utilized in different amounts by different plants. With the organic matter or with the cover crops, the most important thing for me in cover crops is building organic matter in the soil.
Okay.
You know, I'm out here in Texas. It's hot. Soils don't get a good chance to build up organic matter unless... Mm-hmm. And one of our research projects down there with PPC Farms down in the valley was looking at cover crops that were more appropriate for that area. And the growing season is very different from most temperate areas in the country where, you know, all the research is being done about cover crops and all that. I looked through and did a publication about growing cover crops in hot and humid areas. Mm-hmm. I looked at other subtropical regions around the world and assembled a list of things to try. One of those things was pigeon peas or Cajanus cajan.
Oh, okay. As anybody who likes Puerto Rican food, we know what that is.
Yeah. Puerto Ricans eat them, Jamaicans eat them, Gunga peas, and they eat them in Africa and... Mm-hmm. Popular in South Asia. So I wanted to look at that crop because it had so many characteristics that I needed in a crop for the valley. It's, you know, it can withstand subtropical conditions. It's very drought tolerant. It covers the soil. And when I say it covers the soil, it forms a canopy. It's an upright cover crop. So it forms a canopy that is very dense above ground. Now, the drawback about using it as a cover crop is that it needs to be maintained for a while. So I was out there in 100 degree heat with a hoe for weeks on end, keeping the weeds out of the pigeon peas. And they thought I was a madman. Hey, because at the end of the season, we had some pretty good results. I want to say it was, you know, about July when I stopped spending so much time in the field down there.
Okay. When did you start?
In March. Yeah. So what I noticed when I left, it was very, very dry. The plants were about 4 feet tall. They were flowering. And it's a determinate type of pigeon pea. So there's determinate and there's indeterminate. Indeterminate means that it keeps on flowering and growing and flowering. Mm-hmm. The determinate ones, the idea is that they flower all at once really heavy, and then they pod out and you harvest them. Once it started flowering, I thought, you know, hey, it's fine. I'm done. It's got its little canopy. It was about 4 feet tall. I came back in October to do our field day. I didn't recognize my field because what had happened is it rained while I was gone. And I think it rained like two or three times that whole summer. And like I said, over 100 degree heat the whole time. When I came back, the stuff was over 6 feet tall.
Oh, my God.
And it was continuing to flower and pod out. When we did the field day, you know, we had the producers come out there and they looked at it and they were like really impressed, man. Everything else is dead. It's, you know, six or 8 weeks of no rain and solid heat. Everything is dead. And so, I mean, everything non-irrigated. And So they came out there and they saw greenery. And the first thing they asked was, can I feed it to my cattle? And I'm like, yeah, it's a good cattle feed as well as a high protein cattle feed. We walked, you know, from the front of the field through the field. And you notice that, you know, outside of the field where it's been plowed up, it's hard as a rock. I mean, mm-hmm. it's dry. It's just awful. Inside the field, remember I mentioned that it had rained wet in between the rows.
Oh, wow.
It had been a while since it rained. When I say canopy, that's what I'm talking about. Except all that solar radiation before it even hits the soil. What you notice under that canopy is 15 degree temperature drop when you grow from outside the field to underneath the leaf. That's what we want in a cover crop. We want something that covers the soil and lets that organic matter have a chance to build up. Because our organic matter down here is like low. You know, it's supposed to be 5%. Over here, it's less than 2%.
Oh, wow.
Less than 1% in a lot of cases. Because it's just so hot, it burns up. So we don't have that chance for it to build up. So yes, you need to incorporate cover crops into your rotations. What I was doing at Prairie View is I would do a spring cover crop and then a fall cover crop. And then after that fall cover crop was finished in early June or late May, I would take it out and I would put sweet potatoes in.
Gotcha.
And then I would put in, after the sweet potatoes came out, I'll put a fall cover crop in and then repeat the cycle. So I would do two cover crops and then a cash crop. So then, you know, I would rotate from sweet potatoes to strawberries, but using cover crops here. But I would always do two cover crops in a row, because that way I can give the soil a little time to, you know, get all that biomass in from those cover crops and depress the weeds. So that was my way of getting rid of like Bermuda grass and nuts edge and
those are pain in the neck up here, boy.
Yeah, all those terrible things. I would use a combination of growing cover crops, two cover crops in a row, and then I would use a reciprocating spader. In between, when I was refreshing the field, I would use a reciprocating spader that would, you know, push everything down in the soil and perfect for planting.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how did you end up terminating and incorporating those pigeon peas when they got that big?
All right, so with the pigeon peas, the way to terminate those is like in India, they just harvest the whole plant. They cut it, pack it up on the outside of the field, it's up, and you know they you know go from there to harvest. They don't walk down the rows, you know, just picking. They cut the branches and stuff and go from there. Hmm. So the way to in our system, what we would do is just mow them.
Okay.
But the interesting thing about the pigeon peas down in the valley is that it did not get cold enough to outright kill them. It persisted into the next season.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, they weren't as vigorous. There's a huge drop in vigor from one year to the next, because they were grown to be annuals. But I thought it was pretty impressive that put a cover crop that could persist for years and years if we let it.
Any chance of it becoming a weed?
That's where I was going to go next.
Okay.
The only way that the pigeon peas reseeded, and you got to, pigeon peas are food. They are delicious peas. So nature and wildlife would eat it if it stayed there too long. The only way that it would reseed is if it fell into a crack in the soil.
Gotcha.
So this expanding clay and all that. If there was a crack in between the clay when it dried out, a little pea fall down to there, and there was just enough moisture to help it germinate. That's the only way it reseeds itself. Other than that, I don't see it becoming a weed.
Okay, because some cover crops you do have to watch out for that. You know, they'll get loose and they just become a weed on you. So we talked about crop rotation. So going back to salt for a minute, you always hear that Epsom salt can be a good source of minerals for plants. Is that true?
Epsom salt provides two things that plants need. One is magnesium, and magnesium is highly leachable from the soil. Mm-hmm. The other thing plants need is sulfur. So
Epsom salt's highly leachable, and
yeah, well, the magnesium in oil is very leachable. Epsom salt provides magnesium. It also provides sulfur.
Okay.
You know, plants use that to make various proteins and all that. So yeah, Epsom salt is useful, but it's only providing those two minerals. Everything is just providing two very useful minerals.
It's not like the sea salt then.
No, it's not like sea salt. Okay.
And when you use your sea salt, I'm figuring you use a granulated sea salt because, you know, they sell it in a rock form as well, you know?
It doesn't matter. As long as you dissolve it in water.
Okay.
I mean, it's going to take a lot more energy for you to dissolve the more coarse, but, you know, yeah.
That's why they make mortar and pestles, man. Just grind that sucker up. So, going back to cover crops for a minute, and I'm glad you brought this up. I know they did, this is about 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah, that they did this multi-state cover crop study. And we had most of the states in the southern region participate. But when they got to Louisiana and Texas, they begged off because they said, you know, you guys may be able to find some cover crops that'll work in your areas pretty good, might be transferable from state to state. But once you get out to Louisiana and Texas, it's a whole different ball game. So can you talk a little bit about how important it is to match the cover crops to your particular environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's just crop selection, just like the other stuff, man. You want to find something that works for you. I actually have a publication called Options for Hot and Humid Areas through the ATRA, ATRA service on the website, and pull up that publication. And I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but it does a really good job of explaining like how you're supposed to pick your cover crops and what you need to look for, the soil conditions and all that sort of stuff. Because I'm the type of person, I get really frustrated having to go to so many different places to find one piece of information.
Right.
So right. I put a table in that publication that it lists out all the characteristics you're looking for in a cover crop. And
what's the name of it again?
It's called Cover Crop Options for Hot and Humid Areas.
And that's probably a good segue for you to talk about your work with NCAT and ATRA. So first of all, what is NCAT?
NCAT is the National Center for Appropriate Technology. They are a nationwide nonprofit organization that acts as alternative extension service for people interested in sustainable and organic agriculture.
Okay.
So ATRA is a service NCAT provides. It's basically like a National Sustainable Agricultural Information Service.
Okay.
So through the ATRA service, we've got a website. We've got on that website, if you want to go learn about how to grow blueberries, instead of going and onto your land and buying a bunch of blueberry bushes and planting them and not knowing what you're doing and lose them, you can go find a blueberry farm on the ATRA thing and go work for somebody else and learn from them.
Right, right.
So we've got hundreds of publications.
And you're based down in...
I'm in Texas.
Yeah, San Antonio? Is that where you're at?
We've got an office in San Antonio, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so we've got an office in California, and we've got one up in Butte, Montana, where our headquarters, and we've got one in Jackson, Mississippi. We've got one in Fayetteville, and then we've got one up in the cold and frozen Northeast. We've got so many different experts, subject matter experts. You know, they know between the ATRA staff, we know everything.
Okay. And if people wanted to get in touch with you just to ask some questions or something, your contact information is on the NCAT website?
On the ATRA website, we have a hotline Monday through Friday where you call and you can talk to one of us ag specialists.
Okay.
So I'm a sustainable agriculture specialist. You can talk to me about things like organic certification or how to choose crops, or how to enhance the crops that you've got, better harvest and yields and that sort of thing. Or if you want to talk about fruit trees, in Fayetteville, Arkansas, Guy Ames, he's like the ultimate, you know, fruit tree resource. He's got his own nursery and he sells all sorts of amazing stuff. But when he works for us, he can help you with your fruit tree problems.
Okay. And then it's typically free of charge, right? Or is there some
charge? Mm-hmm. Yes. It's mm-hmm. it's a free service.
Okay. Well, Justin, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I'm going to put links up on the in the show notes to ATRA and NCAT. And I hope to see you soon, guy. You know, I started editing my own shows because I was paying somebody $40 to do them. And I just, you know, during COVID, money's tight. So this episode has certainly given me something to practice my editing chops on with the
But all the difficulties.
No, I think it was me. And you know what? These companies are getting slick because I called ATT and said I'm having problems, but you never get through to an operator. And they just say, well, everything looks fine. The recording says everything looks fine to me. Because of COVID, we don't know when we can get to you. So.
All right. Cool.
Yeah, it's not. But I want to thank you again for taking time with us. And I'll be in touch to let you know when it's going to air and stuff like that.
All right. Cool.
All right.
All right.
Thanks a lot, man.
Ready.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast, sustainable ag news and views.